Good morning. Welcome to the Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. I'm Madeline Reynolds, the associate producer of the Roundtable on WAMC. Each weekday morning, the Roundtable's Joe Donahue is joined by various experts, journalists, educators, and commentators to discuss current events. On Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review, we feature selections from this week's shows. On Wednesday, April 30th, WAMC on the Road presented the Roundtable Panel at Hartwick College's Shinneman Chapel House in partnership with the Hartwick Institute of Public Service in Oneonta, New York. This entire episode of the Roundtable Panel Week in Review will only feature segments from the panel at Hartwick College. Joe was joined by co-director of Institute of Public Service, professor and chair of the Department of Political Science, Law, and International Relations, Laurel Elder, professor of political science, co-director of the Hartwick Institute of Public Service, Matt Chick, and professor of sociology, co-director of the Hartwick Institute of Public Service, Zachary McKenney. We were also joined by students who are part of the Institute of Public Service program, Amelia Williams, Morgan Nichols, and Jack Reichel.
As we generally talk about 100 days of the Trump administration, Morgan, you told us about your trip and some of the things that where you were during the inauguration, but what has this time sort of been like for you?
So to add to that, like, I first became truly politically mindful.
You have more bad news for us?
No, this is actually pretty good. I became politically mindful while I was in school. I would read the news when I was riding home on the bus, and this was during the Trump-Clinton election, so 2016. I was actually paying attention, and obviously I couldn't vote, not that old. But reading the news then was something else for me because I was a lot more younger and impressionable, so opinions stuck to me more. But now, I'm much older now and going to Europe in January and getting different perspectives, it opens your mind to what kind of news there is out there, what people's opinions really are, and what people think from the outside. I think some people in the U.S. struggle to generally get an idea of like what people in Europe think, and not everyone has the same opinion on that. So like if you ask somebody in Budapest what they think about the United States, especially right now, you're probably not going to get a very positive opinion. But if you go out in the countryside and ask a member of the Fidesz party, which is the right-wing populist party, they may be very positive about it. So from my perspective, being able to see that lets me maybe enhance my personal opinions a little bit more. I try to stand behind what I believe in. Like, I grew up in a conservative household. I generally stick to that, but obviously I differentiate from conservative opinions at times. So it's good to, feel confident I can make those decisions without second guessing and being like, was that really what I believed in, or was it just something that I saw?
But you mentioned this, and I think it's an interesting point, that the difference of going to the city and going out into the country and seeing the differing of opinions, but the same can be said here. Big difference between Albany or New York City or you said you were from Cooperstown, right? Very red.
That was actually the point I was going to make. I'm sorry. That's okay. I personally believe that there is a big dividing line between Cooperstown. Like, I live three miles outside of the town limits, and I wouldn't generally consider Cooperstown like Republican. It's definitely liberal leaning in some ways, but it's very easy to find divides. Like, I feel different, like, being from just outside of Cooperstown, coming to Oneonta, I can definitely feel that there is a difference. Whether that's like a positive or negative difference, it depends on how firm someone is in their beliefs. Like, I try to be flexible. So, when I go to different larger cities, I'm not a city person at all, but I understand the experiences that they have there and what they're going through and what kind of struggles they have, which are a lot different from the struggles that we may see out in the countryside.
Jack, you're a political science major. What were you thinking? No. What has that been like? I mean, I'm asking your professors what they think of this time. How do you feel as a student learning during this time?
It's definitely pretty interesting. I'm currently taking a foreign policy class here at Hartwick, and it couldn't be a better time to be in a foreign policy class because essentially every theory is being tested at every time and then switching back and forth. So it's kind of hard to navigate, but also interesting for that reason. It's definitely a little confusing from my perspective because growing up, really the first political knowledge that I had was under the first Trump administration. Then I had experience under Biden and then the second Trump administration. So knowing what normal is kind of hard to navigate.
that's a hard thing to nail down, isn't it?
Yeah.
So what do you think of when you think when you're taking a political science course? What are you thinking about what you would like to do ultimately, of where you would like to land and be in that?
As far as like a career ambition?
Sure.
So currently I'm interested in pursuing a master's degree in public administration. And I want to get into the national security industry or the defense industry because it seems like a particularly stable industry to pursue a career in. It doesn't seem to be going anywhere.
You're right. Absolutely. Go into the audience. Joe is here. Hi, Joe.
Hello. How are you, Joe?
I'm fine. What question do you have or comment you have for our group?
Okay, so a lot of people who we call the middle or the swing states did vote for Trump administration. And so to anyone on the panel, what do you think about the idea of, well, you know, did some of these people move for valid reasons? Meaning we've had a lot of hegemony and kind of the Democratic Party, you know, arguably presidentially for the last 40 years. And, is there something to it? Is the idea that, like, they were taken advantage of perhaps by interesting messaging and the divides that exist, as Morgan was just talking about? Do you see a path forward, like, trying to work things out with the middle or double down?
All right. Well, let's focus on the last part of that question of how we deal with it and do we try to work together or, as Joe said, double down? Laurel?
My vote is that we work together. And I think that democracy only works if there is compromise and we have a very large and diverse nation. And we really do need to figure out ways to work together. And I know that's become increasingly harder in our nation today. For a long time, it's been the case that we are polarized. A lot of people don't like to admit it, but you generally have a partisan leaning growing up. You know, you lean towards the Republicans or Democrats. And people will say, well, but I make my own decisions. But most people then stick to those decisions, you know, and vote across the board Democrat, across the board Republican. That's become even more intense, and there's now research showing that people's partisanship even influences like where they live, what kind of job they have, of course who they marry. So it's a powerful thing. And what is so powerful about, I think, college and college classrooms is that you do have people with different beliefs coming together and having incredibly civil conversations. And I think, and we're trying to, you know, really promote that with the Institute of Public Service as well. And I mean, it sounds sort of Pollyannish, but I do think those kind of conversations where people can understand where each other are coming from really is at the root of making our democracy work. And I actually think you see a lot of that at the local level, which is, you know, I've told my students and they've gone to local government meetings. And I'm like, you can't even necessarily tell who is the Democrat and who is a Republican. And they agree. You can't, because what you see is local public servants working to make a good outcome for our local area.
Until you see the bumper stickers. I want to get to Zach, but before I do, let me just ask the students, anybody think we should double down?
No.
Yeah, we have enough, right?
I don't think anybody has the energy to double down. I think people are tired of hostility, and we're just going to be politically fatigued. So what's the gain? What's the net gain in doubling down?
Morgan?
I would say that this past election was probably the most politically charged that obviously I've ever seen. I've only experienced, again, like Jack said, you know, the first Trump administration, the Biden administration, and then the second Trump administration.
They're all like that.
Right. But this feels, to me, as, you know, a younger person, it feels like extremely hostile. And it does spill over into local, like, government policies or, you know, discussions. Like, for an example, in around here in small towns and even in Oneonta, there's the Hometown Hero Veterans banners. And in Cooperstown, there was a vote at the Board of Trustees to even consider something like that, and it did fail, but it charged, a lot of people went up on Facebook, their favorite platform, to, you know, argue with each other and complain, and it turned into an all-out war on, like, who's on what side, what businesses to avoid, and...
So honoring the veterans of the town of Cooperstown, or city of Cooperstown? Town. Village?
Village. It's a village.
Village of Cooperstown was seen as political.
Yes. And for, like, there are other things that happen, but...
And when you say failed,
politically charged.
Are they up there now?
They are not. So the vote was over whether to allow banners to hang off of the streetlights and power poles and things like that. And Cooperstown has historical laws that necessarily, like, they don't allow for that to happen, because if you let one in, you have to let them all in. But that, obviously, that kind of justification, the vote failed, all with everyone voting no except for the mayor. So, you know, that was kind of a sign to a lot of people who are potentially more conservative or just veteran-minded generally that Cooperstown may not be favorable to them. But at the same time, the village did, you know, offer alternatives, like to put signs up in some of the village parks, or to, like, there's plenty of veterans monuments, so you can put things around that.
Right. But,
like, exploring alternatives is something that we may potentially have to get better at in the future, instead of being minded on one thing and one thing only.
Zach, I know you wanted to weigh in on this.
Yeah, I just wanted to say, at the risk of sounding Pollyannish, that I do really think it's important that we not double down, and that we think compassionately about folks, and that we try as best as we can to find some compromises. And, you know, I think in responding to Joe Ficano's question from the audience, as well as one of Morgan's points, you know, I also think there's a danger about the urban-rural divide and thinking about sort of rural areas and rural people in these monolithic terms. There are so many sort of stereotypes about rural individuals and rural areas, but, you know, if we really dive into the data, there's so much diversity that exists, and that's definitely evident here. If we think about sort of the U.S. 19th congressional district where we live, you know, we voted for Trump, but at the same time we also elected Josh Riley, a Democrat, and so, you know, I think it's very important to try and acknowledge that and find some common ground by focusing on the issues rather than just this heated rhetoric. And again, just echoing what my colleague Laurel said, I think if we look at the local level specifically, we do see a great deal of compromise taking place. You know, people have much more faith in their local elected leaders than they do at leaders at the federal level. And we've had just wonderful relationships with our Otsego County Board of Representatives, our Oneonta Common Council, our Oneonta mayor, who I know is in the audience as well, too. And here at this level, you really see that, you know, politicians are much more responsive to their citizens' needs. They're much more willing to compromise. And so we hope that that serves as an excellent model for our students.
That was Zachary McKenney on the Roundtable panel on Wednesday, April 30th. We'll be back with more after this break. Welcome back to the Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. On Wednesday, April 30th, WAMC on the Road presented the Roundtable Panel at Hartwick College's Shinneman Chapel House in partnership with the Hartwick Institute of Public Service in Oneonta, New York. Joe was joined by co-director of Institute of Public Service, professor and chair of the Department of Political Science, Law and International Relations, Laurel Elder, professor of political science, co-director of the Hartwick Institute of Public Service, Matt Chick, and professor of sociology, co-director of the Hartwick Institute of Public Service, Zachary McKenney. We were also joined by students who are part of the Institute of Public Service program, Amelia Williams, Morgan Nichols, and Zach Reichel.
Have a few more minutes with this group of students, and we're going to welcome another group of students in. I wanted to get to a student in the audience. Josie is with us. Josie, what's on your mind?
Hi there. So my question is to Morgan or anyone in, no one in particular here. These first 100 days have seen a lot of international foreign relations being sort of mixed up and scrambled up a lot, in particular, sort of threats of making the United States, making Canada the 51st state, or other comments about Greenland. And my question is, how can we sort of bridge the gap we've seen in between our neighbors recently? How can we sort of fix our relations with our northern neighbor?
Great question. Morgan, it's all yours.
It's going to be very hard to repair those relationships, at least in the short term, because, like, between the commentary Trump put out there and, you know, other people in the Republican Party and in the administration, like, obviously they paid for that. Like, conservatives, while they did decently well in the Canadian elections, obviously they did not win a plurality or majority or anything like that. Obviously they paid the price for it. And politicians that follow that same mantra obviously are going to hurt for it while this administration's struggling to get its act together. I mean, would I say that we're kind of getting essentially what we voted for with Trump? I would say so. Like, if you pay attention to what he says, we're definitely, you know, what's happening was going to happen anyway. I think an article just came out either this morning or just recently that Trump commented saying that you got what you voted for when it comes to the tariffs. Like, this is something that was voted for. But when it comes to repairing those relationships, it's going to take a lot, like we're doing here, between, like, deliberating and just talking. And that may not necessarily be enough. We may have to come up with favorable compromises, either economically or something like that. But to repair, like, you know, already very destroyed bridges, like, you're going to have to rebuild it through conversations and healing is just going to come with time. I can't speak for how Republicans are going to handle that, nor can I speak for how anyone else would handle it, but opening conversations, talking with people, talking with the new prime minister, talking with various leaders on both sides, and trying to find something that we can agree on, at the very least, is a good start.
We have to bring the show to Hungary?
That's
anybody else? Yes.
Yeah, so I think it's interesting when you consider relations with other countries under the Trump administration. And in studying foreign policy, especially this year, I've seen that this is more so a larger trend of the United States steering towards unilateralism or individual action and steering away from multilateralism. I mean, you could even go back to 2001 where Article 5 of NATO was invoked. And the U.S. went on its own and conducted Operation Enduring Freedom on its own, avoiding coalition assistance for our own independent operations. So unilateralism and ignoring what is effectively our alliances is not necessarily a new trait in U.S. foreign policy.
Yeah.
Amelia.
So this past J term, I was in Senegal, and it was just very interesting because we actually went to the USAID center that was in Senegal, and I was actually really devastated when I was talking to one of the workers there, and she was saying she doesn't know if she's going to have a job this time next year, and which she doesn't because USAID is completely, like, gone now in so many different countries. And I think the larger issue here that we have to really start thinking about is the fact that, and I think Americans are very guilty of this, is what doesn't happen on national soil isn't our problem. But what we fail to realize is that USAID is countries quite literally depend on this for not only their infrastructure, not only reducing crime, not only ensuring that people have education, not only ensuring that people have clean water, not ensuring that victims of domestic violence or child marriages aren't happening, and we don't talk about this stuff, and it's like these institutions are being completely eradicated, and it's just another thing that happens that we don't take the time to actually be compassionate about and actually talk about and put at the forefront at a lot of these conversations. And yes, it can be acknowledged that like foreign policy is complex and it is very intricate and there's a lot of policy involved. But at the end of the day, these are real people, real lives that are being directly affected. And I think, strongly believe actually, that if the US is trying to be invested in other countries, be invested for the right reasons and don't hurt more than you do help.
Yeah, to build off of that, I've traveled to 32 countries.
You should clap for that, ladies and gentlemen. Go ahead, Jack.
Yeah, so to build off of that, I've traveled to 32 countries, most of which receive some form of U.S. aid. And in particular, on J-term, this previous J-term, I was in the Federated States of Micronesia, which received over $250 million of U.S. aid in 2024. Now they receive $230,000. So completely floundering any public sector development, any economic development in the country. And it's a strategic error, too. If you think about the location of that country, they're in the South Pacific. That is a great place to conduct operations and ensure that rising powers like China can't assert their dominance in Asia or globally.
I mean, this gets to the question I was asking you earlier about like strategy, policy, like trying to figuring this out of like, where we're going to go with all of this and what's the end game. And I think a lot of us are trying to figure that out. Let's go to Carrie, who's in the audience. Carrie, go ahead.
Thanks, Joe. So my question to the panel is, today's the 50th anniversary of fall of Saigon, and how do you feel that the war in Vietnam and the tumultuous times of the 1960s and 70s has influenced the political times that we live in today? Thanks.
Oh, all right. Who wants that one? That sounds like a paper. Anybody?
I'll try and
okay.
Add that question.
All right.
Very good one. I don't know
Thank
that
you,
I have
Zach.
The expertise to address it entirely, but I think certainly reflecting on, 50 years since the end of the Vietnam War, one is just that it was, I think, a very humbling experience for the United States. We certainly lost that war, and we saw so many of the atrocities that we committed there. But I think it's also a really good time as well to reflect on a great deal of the activism that took place in response to the war in Vietnam. If we look at the social movements that really mobilized in opposition to it, and many of them were student-led. If we think about the student movement taking place on campuses as well as explicitly the anti-Vietnam War movement. And so I think one of the lessons that we should definitely take away from that is the importance of mass organization and of mass mobilization in order to stand up, for injustices.
Matt, what do you think?
I mean, I'm just going to build off Zach's answer because I don't have one of my own. But I think that
if a student did that,
yeah, well, that would be fun. I mean, they were listening and paying attention and all that good stuff. No, but I wonder if so. This isn't quite as optimistic sounding, but I wonder if the influence is in the fact that, as Zach was saying, some of those protest movements were and social activism movements were rather successful. If part of the reason we see a lot of the cracking down on the ability to sort of protest and the punishments that come along with civil disobedience is another kind of lesson learned as the folks in power try to make sure parallel movements are not as successful.
Anybody else want that?
I think from a foreign policy perspective, it's quite interesting because the Vietnam War probably influenced a large portion of Americans' views on the war in Afghanistan, that long and protracted military engagements in foreign countries are not necessarily conducive to a positive environment in the U.S.
Back to the audience.
Yes, I'm Paul. I did want to congratulate the marvelous students you have here. Was so well spoken. And one of the young gentlemen said he got appointed to the airport commission. I've been on government boards and different things and whatnot. And another phenomenon I'm seeing in the local Congress, and what I experienced when I was on those commissions and different things, people do not ask enough questions, okay? You do not have to know everything. But you, if you don't know something, don't be afraid to ask a question that might indicate, we don't know, that's okay. And you keep asking questions until the experts start dancing, and then you know you got them, okay?
Well, that's the second half of the show, when they start dancing.
But anyway, I
have my dollar bills ready.
But anyway, I want to thank you all, and it's important that you people, young people like you, get engaged, get out there, ask the questions, whatever you think you're going to be doing, because you are the ones who are going to hopefully prevent this phenomenon from happening again, and I won't have to cross my fingers.
A fellow nodder here as well.
Oh, I was just agreeing with, like...
All right, that's all right. That's fair. That's fair. All right. Excellent. All right. Anybody else in the audience? Look at all these hands. We have a second part, too, but we'll get to everybody before, about 2 or 3 minutes before we change out the students. Yeah, go ahead.
I'm a local government official for my town. I'm a town board member, and I'm all for keeping dialogue open across all ideologies. The thing that I think is getting lost in discussion of the policies under the current administration is the underlying strategy of what they're doing to change the nature of democracy in America to more of a unitary executive and to neuter the other branches of government. And they throw so much at the wall so quickly that keeps everybody talking about policy and not about their strategy.
Go back here. Anybody want to comment about that?
I actually do have a comment about that. I think that I fully agree. I think that the conversation is often shifted from policy and often shifted from the quote-unquote important issues, and then we start talking about Trump the person. And I think a lot of times people say, oh, he has no strategy, but that is the strategy, you know what I mean? And I think we would be very foolish if we get distracted from what his administration, they're very calculated, is trying to do and what they have been doing and what they're going to continue to do, because the plan has always been to confuse, to distract, and to implement policy. Because a lot of times we're like, oh, you know, this would never happen, and then it happens, and then we're like, how did this happen? But they've been planting seeds for months before that. And I think we need to get out of this idea of this could never happen, because we've always said that, like, oh, he's never going to get reelected. Well, here we are 100 days in. So I think, yeah, I do agree with you.
That was Amelia Williams on the Roundtable panel on Wednesday, April 30th. We'll be back with more of the Roundtable panel The Week in Review after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. WAMC On the Road presented the Roundtable panel at Hartwick College's Shinneman Chapel House in partnership with the Hartwick Institute of Public Service in Oneonta, New York. This segment will feature a new group of students. Joe was joined by co-director of Institute of Public Service, professor and chair of the Department of Political Science, Law, and International Relations, Laurel Elder, Professor of Political Science, co-director of the Hartwick Institute of Public Service, Matt Chick, and Professor of Sociology, co-director of the Hartwick Institute of Public Service, Zachary McKenney. We were also joined by students who are part of the Institute of Public Service program, Cooper Conan, Hannah Gilland, and Avante Palmer.
The loose framework of today's show is 100 days of the Trump administration. But what impact do you think just politics in general has on college life, on campus life?
I mean, I'll be quite honest. In like the most forward sense, nothing's really changed. I'm still going to classes. I'm still doing the things I need to do. Just because we have a new president doesn't mean my entire world is flipped on its head.
Yeah.
But I will say that my relationships with people, my conversations with people is so contentious. And for why, I don't know. But it's a battle of like, who did you vote for? I'm gonna guess who you vote for if you didn't tell me. I'm gonna judge how you dress, and I'm gonna guess who you voted for. I'm gonna judge the way you walk, and I'm gonna guess who you voted for. It's this whole like complete divide when it's really doesn't have to be that way.
Do you know what the second part of that is? Like what they do with that information?
I really don't.
It's processed?
I really don't. Because I don't see why it's helpful whatsoever. If you find out who I voted for, that's great. But we can have a conversation, but I don't think you're going to change the way I dress.
Yeah. And do you feel it to be contentious, Cooper?
Oh, most certainly, Joe. You know, I think, and it's not just with this past election, but with a lot of elections past, you know, you see it devolve into a sort of, you know, tribalism. You know, if you're not with my side, then you're against me. And if you're against me, well, then I just don't like you. You know, you see a lot of the term used in past elections, mudslinging. And to be sure, that's definitely happened in this election. But I think it's gone beyond mudslinging. I think they've started picking up rocks, bits of broken glass.
Yep.
You know, it's just become very angry. And it doesn't have to be that way.
What do you think, Avant?
I think that we're all human beings. And whether you're red or blue, you're entitled to your perspective. It might have a big impact on a broader aspect. But I do think everybody's entitled to their side.
But and would you agree with Hannah that it had an impact on the relationships and people that you talked to?
To be more specific, I would say yes, it has had an impact. Like Trump had an executive order towards the DEI, and for me that impacted me big time because I am a DEI advocate in our Belonging Center, and when we saw that the name was taken down, it was detrimental. It left a hole in our chest. Because that's our name, that's our identity. And we hold, the space holds value for students like me because it provides a sense of safety and comfort. So when that was taken away, it kind of left feelings of uncertainty and discomfort. But we're still here and there's essence in our presence. And I think it's important to know that spaces like DEI is important.
Cooper, when you see things like that, happening on campus, how do you react to it?
Things like
removal of DEI, programs that are cut that affect students and friends and relationships that you have here on campus.
I think there are the very real impacts, like Avante was talking about, with people's lives and, you know, how their emotional and mental state of being can be affected. But I also think it feeds back into what I was saying earlier with, you know, the sort of tribalism. You know, if you say, for example, were for the cutting of the DEI programs, you know, you've suddenly alienated part of the campus. But if you were for them, you've also alienated the other part of the campus. And I think it just, regardless of if you are affected or not, you know, we have to understand that even if you disagree with the cutting of DEI, you have to still be able to work with people who, you know, supported it.
Right. How do you make that point in class, Zach?
It's very difficult. I think that one thing that, you know, faculty members definitely need to do, though, is not to shy away from it, that these are very important issues, that it's important to discuss them with students. And so I think that, you know, in many ways, the worst thing to do is to do nothing. And, you know, sometimes I hear faculty members who are hesitant to address some of these issues because they themselves don't necessarily feel like they're equipped to begin to have this conversation. But I would just say, again, it's better to do something than to do nothing. And I think that when we pose these questions to our students, you know, as long as you have really ensured that your classroom is a safe space where people can share different views where they can feel comfortable opening up about them, and hopefully, you know, train the students to recognize that we all come from different perspectives, that our views are informed by any number of things, and just to be sort of very charitable in interpreting, you know, other individuals' comments and expect them to be charitable in doing so as well, too. And I do think that once you've sort of established that, once you've established a space and a rapport with the students, then you see it is very possible for them to have open and honest discussions about these things, that we can disagree, but we can disagree respectfully, and that hopefully there is, you know, some way that we can find some middle ground and some compromise. And so, I mean, I just echoing what each of our students have said in regards to sort of the polarization, I mean, just trying to stress that, you know, compromise does not have to be a dirty word, and that compromising doesn't mean that you've lost, and that this is really just a way to be much more inclusive of everyone and to have these honest and important conversations.
Laura?
I'll echo something someone said earlier. The tension around discussions of issues relating to diversity, race, and ethnicity is, it's not new. I teach a class on the politics of race and ethnicity. I have for 25 years, as I said, that I've been here. And there's been some very, very heated moments in that class before Donald Trump was even thinking about running for. In fact, I remember one time two students were like, in class, they were like, do you want to take it outside? I was like, no, we're not going to do that. You know, I do think that you have to keep in mind that colleges and universities are one of the most, like, racially integrated spaces you have in America today. Our young people are a very diverse group of people. And still today in America, we live very segregated lives. If you look at neighborhoods and workplaces, there's still, you know, it's not required by law, but it's still very, you know, not that integrated. And so colleges and universities, you have young people here. A lot of them are exposed to more diversity, different kinds of diversity than they have before. And I do think, like Zach said, it is our job as professors to guide these conversations. And I also think last year, SUNY Oneonta brought Clint Smith to give a talk, and he's just amazing. He wrote the book, How the Word is Passed. And he talks in that book about going at people, being like, you are wrong, you need to rethink your belief, and this is why. Doesn't tend to work. He talks about you need to give people the space to negotiate their identities. They hear about other people's experiences, and then you give them the space to integrate that, to think about it. And I think that's so powerful. And I've seen this, you know, and I'm not saying, you know, people can think whatever they want, but just I have seen so many young people, and this is the amazing thing about working with young people. They are open to learning new information and integrating it into their views of the world. And you see them make those changes, and it's incredible. It's like, it's such a gift being a professor and working with these students and seeing those kind of developments.
I had a good discussion going into the break about the importance of having these discussions, but Matt, I know you wanted to weigh in too before we go into the audience.
Yeah, I was just gonna say quickly, on that really generative discussion from all the other panelists, I was thinking about a couple different ways in which we think about democracy, but I think one of the fundamental things in any democracy is to remember, like, there's always winners and losers, right? It's a competitive struggle for ideas and power. And one of the things that, one of the ways in which we might measure how well we're doing as a democracy is what happens to the losers and how do they feel? Right? So there's a really powerful theory that says, like, part of the problem, Danielle Allen, she's an amazing political theorist. She actually was exploring running for governor of Massachusetts. I don't think she ever made it. Like I said, political theorists don't tend to do a lot of other stuff. No, but Allen's amazing. And, you know, she suggests that, you know, part of the problem in our current democracy is that it tends to be the same groups that are losing over and over again, and for specific reasons related to their kind of races and identities. And this is really the problem. Like, we don't really have this kind of pluralist system that we would like to have. So there's a lot more. There's a lot of other things I thought about, but I think that maybe is the most relevant too.
Absolutely. Anybody want to add to that? Thoughts on that? Yeah.
Could I just add to the idea of having these conversations?
Yes.
When we're talking about politics, I feel like it's important to avoid what I like to label, you know, logical jumps. When we ask people questions on their stances on things, we tend to jump and assume just because they feel one way on an issue that they feel this way on other issues. So, Joe, if I asked you, do you like pancakes?
Yeah.
So you like pancakes. You must hate waffles, right? You must really hate waffles.
Well, I don't know. You're looking at me right now. You know I like both.
And as that might be, Joe, you know, but that's my kind of point is we see these kind of jumps in logic where you ask somebody for their stance on one issue, and okay, be what it may, you take that and then you immediately assume that they have all these other stances on other issues, and I think that's a real problem.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. And because a lot of it is just assumption, right? We don't know. We haven't had the discussion. We just, as you were saying earlier, Hannah, if you're judging people by what they're wearing, for God's sakes. It's not, it doesn't go much deeper than that. To the audience, hello.
Hello.
What is your name?
Ed Pixley.
Hello, Ed. What's on your mind?
I just want to ask.
Oh, Ed got a Ed got clapping. Ed's what? Ed's a tenor, all right.
I just wanted to ask Professor Elder about her statement about importance of diversity on campus and how she and other members of the panel feel about what the current administration is trying to do to destroy diversity on campus.
The tenor wants to know.
Yes, yes. And I do have thoughts, but I'm actually going to turn it to Amante because I know this is something he's thought about and wants to speak about as well.
Go.
So thank you for that question. I would say when you were here, you came and asked what our reaction is to it. But I would say there's really no reaction because we're trying to be proactive towards the initiative and making sure that diversity, equity, and inclusion and belonging is here on campus. Whether or not it's taken away, we will still make sure that students feel like there's spaces where they can be diverse, spaces where they feel that they're equitable, spaces where they feel they're included, and spaces where they feel they belong. So whether or not it's taken away or not, it's not going to go anywhere, like I said, because students like me are still here, and then we have everybody who thinks the same way and wants to advocate for the same things.
Anybody else on that?
Well, I was just going to encourage, Avante has done some programming here at Hartwick that has really sort of spearheaded, you know, celebrations of diversity. I'm thinking of the block party. I'm thinking of the fashion show. Do you just want to talk about some of your leadership of those events?
Yeah, I think coming from the Bronx, I have a lot of style. Just bringing...
Damn right he does.
Just bringing that to campus and trying to enhance campus culture in any way I can. I think having programs like that is essential because those are the things that you really remember. Yeah, it's important to get the degree, but when you really look back at the memories, you'll be like, oh, I remember I did this, I did that, and it was fun. And not only was it fun, it was educational. And, you know, it's important.
Is it hard to get those programs off the ground? I mean, have you found where you say, okay, this is what I would like to do, but now I actually have to do it?
It's definitely, you got to have the vision first, and then you got to execute, and it doesn't always... work out the first time, but once you're consistent and passionate, the results will show.
And then you also have your schoolwork and have to get that paper in.
Yeah. Exactly.
Excellent.
I have to add too, Joe, that I was speaking with Avante before this event, and we were talking about how excited we were to have WAMC on the road at Hartwick. And I said, Avante, this has got to be the biggest event of the semester. He said, McKinney, second biggest fashion show, number one.
This is true.
I have no doubt about that. I think I agree with you entirely. We're not looking to be ranked. Tom, go ahead.
Jeff,
go ahead. Who's Tom? Do we have a Tom? Oh, he left. Okay, yeah, go ahead.
You know, in the last 25 years, we've seen a Supreme Court hijack a presidential election. We've seen the Iraq War, the rise of Homeland Security and ICE. We've seen a Senate majority steal two Supreme Court nominations. And the last 100 days, we've seen a lot, including, as of last night, another instance of open defiance of a Supreme Court order. So I have two questions. For Laurel, I'd like you to define resilience in the face of that. And to the students, how much faith do you have in these institutions that the older of us in the crowd grew up feeling was secure, and now we're realizing is something of a handshake deal that, you know, has no real backing to it? So those are my two questions.
All right, good question. Let's start with resilience.
One thing I would say, so what is resilience? I also think my colleague Matt Chick, who studies democratic theory, might have more to say on this theory. But, you know, I'm sure a lot of people have seen the recent polls that have come out. New York Times had polls and a whole bunch of news organizations to coincide with Trump's 100 days in office. And what those polls are showing is that there is people are pushing back against the overreach of presidential power, and that, you know, Trump during his first administration, his approval ratings were like 42%, like almost the whole time, which is not high, but it's actually not that low either. Joe Biden had lower levels of approval rating because not only did he, you know, no Republicans approved of him, but he lost the support of some Democrats too. And what these polls are showing is that there's even a fair number of Republicans who are uncomfortable with some of Trump's uses of executive power, his overreaches of power. And so I think that's one sign where we're seeing Democratic resilience. We have a culture that values the Constitution and the rights and the idea of equality. And I think that even though there are many people who like just are passionate about Donald Trump, that there's limits to how far we will go as a country. So that's one place where I see some resilience occurring.
Yeah, I guess I'll just throw in quickly because I do want to get to the students. You know, so that's kind of the optimistic take, and Laurel's right, that's how I read the polls as well. But I think the worry is, I think, Joe, you asked this in a different context, but like, so like, what's the next thing that happens? Yeah. Because I think one of the things that's unique about Trump is he just doesn't seem to care very much about sort of, particularly, now some of this is normal, right? It's a second term president, it's a president that probably won't have to face voters again. He did win more votes than his opponent, which is different than 2016, right? So all of these things, we see every president sort of claim a stronger mandate to be able to do stuff. But I think to Jeff's original question, the idea of kind of ignoring members of his own party, ignoring the Supreme Court, ignoring sort of public opinion so far is not super optimistic. So what happens next? Do members of Congress that are Republican actually start to notice these public opinion polls and do something, or be willing to kind of act as a bulwark? Maybe, maybe not. We know from political science research that the courts tend to be a little bit more confident when they see public opinion is sort of on their side. So that's kind of like what's going to happen with this. You know, I think Laurel's absolutely right that the public is disapproving in a lot of its significant ways, but I don't know what's going to happen next, right? I think that's the next, the fear or the pessimism.
Amelia was on the panel before. Now she has a question.
Hi, guys. So I have a two-part question. The first part of my question is to the professors, and it's how do we manage mobilization of students in these unprecedented times? And then the second part of my question is to the students, and this goes along with Avante's point that he was talking about DEI, and we both work in the Belonging Center. And I think a lot of the times people equate DEI to Black or DEI to minority, but disregard the fact that it encompasses so many, like just a wide variety of issues. And I think that we think that discomfort equals discrimination. So how do us, like us as students, navigate being well informed about exactly what these policies are, what these initiatives are, and how not only do we educate ourselves, but also educate our peers?
All right, so let's take that second part first. Avante?
I would say, like Amelia did say, diversity, equity, inclusion is not just towards the minority. It is towards the broad aspects of students. You have international students. You have, it's basically for everybody. It's for everyone. That's why it's inclusive. And I think to be further educated is to just stop by the center or just do your own research and actually care I don't think people care enough to know what it is, so that they're incompetent and don't know what they're talking about when it comes to DEI. So that's how I think they could enhance their knowledge about this important topic.
Laurel, the first part of Meredith's question.
So I think as a political scientist, I'm not, I really try to approach the, you know, my classroom and in, you know, based on like the social science research, looking at things objectively. I want students to have their own views, but to be informed. And I feel my job is to give them a set of tools that they can use to then pursue whatever political views or, you know, social mobilization they want to engage in. I do teach a public service internship class, and I want them to learn, like, here are ways that you can get, you know, mobilized. You can go to Albany and talk to legislators. You can, you know, call different members of Congress. Here's a toolkit, and you can use it to pursue. So I'm not trying to get them to, you know, join one movement or another. I just are like, here are different tools you can use if you are passionate about something and you want to make a difference in your community or your state or your nation. So that's my approach to it.
All right. We have about just under 10 minutes left in the broadcast. What I'd like to do is just go around, and if anybody has any quick comments that they'd like to make, I'd love to hear them. So if you just raise your hand, I'll come over to you. And we'll get going on that. Yes.
Hi, Dave Hutchison, retired faculty from Hartwick. I retired in the year 2000, the same year Laura came. Anyhow, I just want to comment that I'm disappointed
He's a geology professor.
In that we're not talking about environment. As a geologist, we wouldn't be here, but we're diminishing our extinction here in terms of the time frame. We are now sitting on rocks that are 400 million years old, Devonian rocks, before fish were around. And we now look at the valley that was glaciated about 10,000 years ago. So in that time frame, human beings have made a hell of a difference, and if we don't maintain the environment, we're cooked.
And students, you're worried about that too?
If I might jump in on that, I would say the environment is a big concern of mine and human impact, you know. As a history major, you know, one of the big questions I often get asked is, what's your favorite president? And more often than not, I usually go to Teddy Roosevelt, not for least because he started the national park system. I think it's important for this nation to recognize that humans every day, you know, from as little as just you or I to the big corporations, are having a massive impact on our environment. And it's usually not for better, usually for worse. And I think we, not just as a nation, but as a planet, need to come to terms with the fact that this is our Earth. We only get one of them. You know, we have to treat it right.
Hannah.
I just wanted to make a point to note that I feel like a lot of the environmental talk is all focused around what we can do as individuals. And while I think that's incredibly important and we can do things as individuals, it's not as big of a deal as big corporations just doing whatever they want to our planet. They can just dump whatever they want. They can just emit all these fumes. I think if we really care about our environment, we can do as much composting and gardening as we want, but we need to hold these other people accountable who can actually make huge differences.
Kind of to jump on to what Hannah was saying, you know, one of my classes here with Professor McKinney, we're watching a documentary that talks about DuPont chemical plant that was down in West Virginia that produced Teflon and kind of the large impact that they had on the environment. And as unfortunate as a disaster as that was, I feel like it could have been avoided if we hold these big corporations more accountable.
All right. Quick question. Comment. I saw a video on YouTube the other day about elephants clumping together in face of the conflict with the earthquake thing, yes. Right? So it reminded me that we are mammals too, and that we tend to circle the wagons. So I'm interested in the balance between fear and empathy, and if you could comment on that.
I'd so rather be with the elephants.
Go ahead.
I think it's extremely important to have empathy, but I do think there is a point where you realize you can't have empathy for everything because it becomes so exhausting. You have to remember to make to take care of yourself before you can reach out and take care of everybody else. I think it's important that we work together, but we all need to have like kind of like this refresh of like, okay, now let's go get the job done, rather than like, oh my gosh, what do we do? What do we do? And kind of like be like, okay, I'll support you, you support me, we'll support each other. And then everyone just gets burnt out super fast.
Is it hard to take care of yourself in this environment?
A little bit. I mean, double majoring, you have a lot of classes and a lot of papers you have to write, but I don't think it's impossible. I think you can take a deep breath
and
relax. Life balance college.
Life balance college.
I just wanted to say, you know, I think the elephants grouping together in an earthquake, I think that's a wonderful analogy for what happens a lot of the time in politics. You often see politicians run on a platform, not necessarily of what will happen if you elect them, but what will happen if you don't elect them. You know, they play a lot on people's fears of, if you don't elect me, the other party will do this, they'll do that. And it just feeds into the sort of tribalism that I was talking about earlier.
All right.
I'll just throw in while you grab another question there that fear and other emotions like it seem like one of the building blocks to start to see commonality with people that we disagree with, because oftentimes we don't share a lot of the same values, and so it's very hard to generate those compromises and conversations. But I think a lot of people are afraid, and they're just sort of expressing it in very different ways. So those kinds of emotions can often serve as starting points to come together.
I want to ask, are students sufficiently alarmed that in the first 100 days, the Republicans have started their program to destroy our government, to do everything they can just to get big tax cuts for the oligarchs and the rich white people in this country, and destroy the environment and our relations all over the world? Are they sufficiently alarmed?
This is where I say we have 30 seconds for that question.
I'll just jump in and say that I think certain things and a lot of things people shout out and talk about is alarming. I know something that's been kind of mongering around is like, oh, like FAFSA and all of their kind of grants and stuff are going to be cut. And that would be a huge detriment to me, because I'm here at college on a lot of like federal grants that I got for like the Pell Grant. And if something like that ever were to be cut, I don't know how I'd come to school. And so like that's something that personally impacts me a lot, and that's something I worry about. I will say though, I don't think I can spend my entire day worrying. I can't sit in my class and go, oh my gosh, I might not be able to come to class tomorrow because they might cancel the Pell Grant. So it's like you have to still work in strides and have confidence in what you are doing in the moment. You can worry about the things that are happening and influence and how you interact with the public and voter engagement in the future, but you also have to not be so full of fear in every single day, or it's going to drive you mad.
Anybody else with that? Monte? Cooper?
I mean, I just kind of want to say, I think it's important to be aware and understand the issues that are set before this country. But at the same time, being aware doesn't mean that you have to, you know, worry about how things will go on. You know, I think things will certainly be very different moving forward, especially with a lot of the cuts that we're likely going to see with the government. But I don't think that's a reason to, you know, bury our heads into the sand and prepare for doomsday, you know. In the words of one of my favorite movies, life finds a way.
That was Cooper Conan on the Roundtable panel on Wednesday, April 30th. Full episodes of the Roundtable panel are available online at wamc.org/roundtable. This has been this week's Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. I'm Madeline Reynolds. Thank you for listening.